Acclaimed playwright August Wilson, who died in 2005, was approached about making a film from his 1985 play that won both the Pulitzer Prize and a Tony Award, but he held out, insisting that only a black director could make it. Now under the direction of Denzel Washington, Wilson's screenplay for Fences is a 2017 finalist for the Academy Award. In this archive, New Letters on the Air, Wilson talks about his evolution as a playwright and the characters who people his plays.
They're not like cardboard characters. Why? Because they're expressing philosophical ideas. Very often, some of the same ones that you as an audience member have, then you can identify with them. So, yeah, I like that guy. Why? Because he thinks like I do.
The past American voice of August Wilson today on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. August Wilson is credited with expanding the range of American theater. His plays are characterized by the African-American speech patterns and rhythms of his native Pennsylvania, along with a heavy dose of the blues. Raised with five siblings by a single mother in Pittsburgh's tightly knit Hill neighborhood, Wilson was always aware of the greater but unspoken hardships of those who went before. That prompted him to commit to the daunting task of portraying African-American life in a cycle of 10 plays, one for each decade of the 20th century. In 2002, when he was in Kansas City for what was then the Missouri Repertory Theater and their production of his play Joe Turner's Come and Gone, August Wilson discussed his development as a writer and the creative process behind his plays.
I'm working on a ninth one now, so I have two more, and that's what I call the bookends, the first decade and the last decade of the century. And I'm working on the first decade now, so when I finish that, that will be nine. And I'll have one more to do, and I'm going to write that in about 3 days, just so I can be finished.
Wow. Yeah. Is that how you usually approach your writing, is to just try to get it out there as fast as you can and then go back and revise?
Or? No. No, yeah. That's not our approach at all. But I suspect when you're that close to having finished, you know, and you say, all I have to do is I write one more play to finish this project that I started 20 years ago, my assumption is that you would want to do that very quickly and get it over with. I don't know, it may take 3 years to do the last one. I'm not sure.
What people may not realize is that you wrote several plays and you were honing your craft for a long time before Ma Rainey's Black Bottom got picked up by the Eugene O'Neill Center. Is that right?
No.
No?
I mean, they did get picked up by the Eugene O'Neill Theater Center in 1982. I started writing plays in 1979. Well, the first play I wrote was a play called Jitney. And then I wrote a play called Fullerton Street. And then I wrote Ma Rainey. I discovered some things in writing a Jitney, and then the Fullerton Street project I abandoned because it was too large. I was trying to do, as most beginning playwrights do, or most beginning writers, try to do everything in one play, and I was trying to say too much, and it was all confusing and everything. So fortunately, I was able to recognize that, and I just abandoned that, and then I wrote Ma Rainey's Black Bottom and discontinued from there. And having written Ma Rainey's Black Bottom and going to the O'Neill Theater Center's National Playwrights Conference in 1982. That was really inspiring, and that emboldened me to write the next play because I said, oh, wait a minute, I can do this. And then, you know, I wrote Fences and et cetera.
Didn't you try for the Eugene O'Neill Center a couple of times before?
Oh, yeah, in 1980. In the O'Neill, they had stage plays, and they had you could also submit a screenplay. So that's two opportunities to get accepted. So in 1980, I sent the very first play I wrote was a musical satire called Black Bart and the Sacred Hills. And I sent that, and I worked up a little screenplay called Why I Learned to Read, and they sent them both back to me. And then the next year, I sent Jitney, which I had written, and I sent another play, I don't remember, and they sent both of those back. So that's four scripts. And the next year, I sent Jitney back to them twice. And they sent it back to me twice, and that's when I said, well, you know, you have to write a better play if you want to go to the O'Neill. And I said, well, how do you do that? Because I'm already working at the top of my talent. And they said, well, write above your head. And I thought, well, you know, how can you do that? And I thought, well, you can write beneath your talent, can't you? And I go, yeah, well, if you can write beneath it, you must be able to write above it. And so I consciously made a decision to try to write the best play that had ever been written with Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. And having raised my sights, I think I did write above my head and came up with a better play. And then I went to O'Neill. And
wow. Well, who gave you that advice? So you got some response to your...
No, it's myself. I've always kept my own counsel. And, you know, I'm sitting there and saying, oh, what do we do now? It was a self-dialogue. Why are you writing these plays? I asked. I said, because I want to go to O'Neill. And then I said, well, if you wrote the best play that's ever been written, would you go to the O'Neill? And I go, well, yeah, of course. And I said, well, why don't you do that? And I go, oh, novel idea, you know. You see, when you're beginning playwright, you're sitting on the right, you're just hoping to get a play on the paper. You're not thinking about beating Chekhov at his own game, you know. But you go, why not? And I think that's what you should be aiming for. And it's because his words on paper. And so I love Chekhov. I look at Chekhov. I go, yeah, that's cool. It's words on a paper. You all start with the blank page. And then when I discovered, I sat down one day, I go, I'm sitting in the same chair that Eugene O'Neill sat in. I'm sitting in the same chair as Tennessee Williams, Chekhov, and Ibsen. We're all playwrights. We all have the same problems. We all start with the blank piece of paper. We're all confronted by the problems of craft, how to get a character on stage, off stage. And they're no different than me. They just proved that they could do it. So why don't I prove that I can do it? And the other thing is that, like, words are free. It doesn't cost you anything. You do not have to go down and say, can I get 2 pounds of words? Or can I have a 1,000 right. words and here's my $10? And if it doesn't work, throw it in the trash can and write something else because it's free. It didn't cost you. Also, if you have bad days, you can't do anything wrong. You know, you can't tell me this is wrong. This is my way of doing it. And maybe it doesn't work, but I can't do anything wrong. Mm. And so with those kinds of things, I felt empowered by the knowledge that I was sitting in a chair that I could be Chekhov if I wanted to. You see, because any painter who stands before a canvas is Picasso until proven otherwise. But at that moment, you are the best. And then, you know, he starts doing that stuff. You go, well, not quite, but potentially you are, you see. And so you're emboldened by that. And I think it was that kind of thinking that enabled me to write a play like Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which was certainly unlike anything I had written, and I suspect unlike anything anyone else had ever written also.
You're listening to the late August Wilson, who wrote the multi-award-winning play Fences, now a film filled with his rich characters that make up his Pittsburgh cycle. This is New Letters on the Air.
You know, it's no surprise to me that Chekhov is a playwright that you really admire, because one of the things that he was a master at was characterization. His characters were so vibrant and so real, and that's what all of your plays contain to me. You know, the characters, they're so well developed, even the more minor characters, you have this sense of development in them that I think it's difficult to achieve. And
well, I'm not sure if it's difficult to achieve. I think it's where you start from. In other words, if characterization is important to you, and the play emanates out of the lives of the characters, then, you know, then you'll create good characters. If you're the playwright whose approach to the play is by plot, then you're going to have these strong plot points that proceed. There are plot points in my play, but they're difficult to find because they're not in neon.
They're not,
you know,
obvious.
They're not
at
highlighted.
All. Right.
You know, it's
right.
just, and they come out of the characters. And, you know, so to me, it's just a matter of approach. I think any playwright who sits down and says, I'm going to approach this work of art, you know, through the characters, or would be able to create characterization. I think another thing, I think one of the things that most beginning playwrights falter in is the idea that characters, everybody in life, everybody has a philosophy, and everyone expresses their philosophical idea. Everyone is so anxious all the time to tell other people what they think about the world and where, you know, where they stand on any philosophical point. I see people do this all day standing in a supermarket line. If you keep that in mind, then you'll just say, okay, what are the philosophical ideas that my characters are expressing? And so when you go see them, they're not like cardboard characters. Why? Because they're expressing philosophical ideas. Very often, some of the same ones that you as an audience member have. And then you can identify with them. So, yeah, I like that guy. Why? Because he thinks like I do. You know?
Yeah, that's so true. Well, so when you start on a play, do you actually hear the characters in your head first? Do you see the scene? What is the germination?
I have to be careful with this, because if I say I hear the voices, people think you actually hear them. Of course, I don't actually hear them, you know, but I imagine them talking and I hear the way they would talk. I don't, I work in what I call a black space, in that I don't see the set. I don't care about the set. I'm not interested in the set. You make a decision about where you're going to place these characters. But as their voices come to me, and as I imagine their voices, they're surrounded by blackness. They're just voices in this space, you know, and they say these things and I write them down. At that particular point in time, I don't censor them. I let them say whatever they want to say. because I don't know if it's going to be important or not to the play. You see, my process is finding the play. And so I have people talking, and my job is to find the play out of what they say. As an example, so I'm writing piano lesson, and Boy Willie's like talking to Doka. He says, "Hey, Doka, you know Sutter fell in the well." Well, I don't know who Sutter is. That was a surprise to me. I didn't decide that Sutter was going to fall in the well. He said that, and I wrote it down. You know what I mean? And I didn't stop. I just kept going. I went back, and I said, "Oh, he said Sutter fell in the well. Who's Sutter?" I didn't know. Now I got to find out who Sutter is. So in the process, other characters talking, and then he starts talking about Sutter. And then it comes out Sutter is the guy that used to own his family during slavery. I didn't know that at the time. I didn't know he fell in the well. And then how did Sutter fell in the well? Well, I don't sit down as the playwright and say, "Well, let's see, Sutter fell in the..." I ask the characters, "Hey, man, you know, remember you said Sutter fell in the well? How'd he fall in the well?" He goes, "Well, see, you know, down around in them parts," and, you know, and he explained it to me. And, you know, I said, "Okay, I got that now. I know how Sutter fell in the well. And is this important for the audience to know?" Yes, it is. Then you say, "Okay, who is going to reveal this to the audience? Which of the characters is going to say that?" And I go, "Well, since you the one brought it up, you know, you're the one that says it, you know." And he generally says, "Good. Now, what about that other stuff I said?" I said, "Well, I ain't going to use that, you know." You know, it's a wonderful, it's just fun.
I was about to say fun was the word I was going to use. It sounds like you have a whole lot of fun in the creative process. So you just let it pour out there, and then later you go back and you reshape and figure out, like you said, I'm going to use the well part, but I'm not going to use the rest of what you have to say.
Yeah, well, you know, as I discover as I go along, I really work as a collagist, you know, and I'm a great admirer of Mayor Bearden, who works collage. So you just have little pieces and snatches of things, and your job is to assemble them into an artistic whole that has a certain aesthetic value to it. Other times I've likened it to having a pot as a metaphor, and you put things in your pot. You go, okay, a man with a scar on his face, a black cat, a garden, you know, and you throw all these things in your bicycle, you know, anything you want. It doesn't matter. You know, ideally, you should choose carefully, sort of, what you throw in your pot, but you throw all that in there, and, you know, you just go around collecting different things. And then you say, okay, what do I have? You take out your pot and you say, well, I got a man with a scar on his face, a woman with a scar on her legs, I got a black cat, I got a garden. And you say, okay, now how can I use that? And then you start writing the play, and then the garden creeps up. You know, I have to garden a lot of my plays. I like garden things growing.
I've noticed that.
You know,
right.
And the black cat and
roosters.
Yeah. in my pot for every play I've written, starting with Piano Lesson, I've had a handkerchief, a blue handkerchief with $1,200 wrapped up and tied in this handkerchief. And I tried to work it in Seven Guitars. It didn't work. I tried to put it in King Headley. It didn't work. And I tried to put it in, I've tried to put it in every play, but I could never find a place for it. But I still have it. So now I'm working on this play in 1904. And just as I was sitting here now, I go, well, what about that handkerchief and the $1,200? Maybe I can find a place for it in the play, you know?
The past American voice of two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright August Wilson on New Letters on the Air in 2002 when he was at UMKC for the Missouri Repertory's production of one of his favorite plays. There is a passage in Joe Turner's Come and Gone that I've read. If nothing else ever came out of you, that you would feel proud that you had written that. And so I was going through this play trying to find which passage that might have been. But, you know, there were so many good places that I couldn't narrow it down. I thought, well, I wonder which one it was. So can you solve this mystery for me and read it?
Well, you know, it's a difficult thing to read, and you have to go someplace emotionally to do that.
Oh, but I got you. Well, which one is it? So I won't die of
curiosity.
Well,
there was a bones rising up out of the water at the end of Act One that Loomis was talking about there. And what I meant was that working as an artist, you know, you seek a certain fulfillment. And after I wrote that, I thought, okay, if there's nothing else, if I never write another word, if this is, you know, if I die tomorrow, then I feel fulfilled as an artist, and I'll just take that and, you know, and be satisfied with that. It's something I could be satisfied for my life work, I guess is what I was saying, you know, but it wasn't the last thing I wrote, you know. And I found joy in writing other things, man. It's one of my favorite in the sense that Bynum and Seth are playing dominoes when Loomis enters the house. And Loomis comes in and, you know, Bynum says, "Evening, Mr. Loomis." And says, today's Tuesday, Mr. Nowicki. You got to leave on Saturday, see? And he said, we're not ate already, so my wife roasted up some yams. You got your plate sitting in there on the table. And Bynum starts singing Joe Turner's Come and Gone, the song. And Loomis, you know, asked him, why are you singing that song? You know, I'm singing to entertain myself. And he goes, I don't like you singing that song. You know, so he's creating a disturbance. He said, no, don't worry about it. No problem. I'll sing something else if he doesn't like that. So once the house gets quieted down and Loomis goes and, you know, sits down and begins to eat, then Bynum says, you ever been to Johnstown, Harold Loomis? Now, you look like a fella I've seen up around there. Oh, no place with that name. Now, that's around where I see my shiny man. See, you looking for this woman? I'm looking for a shiny man. Seemed like everybody looking for something. I'm looking for you to come on play these dominoes. That's what I'm looking for. You a farming man, Harold Loomis? You look like you done some farming. Same as everybody, yeah, I done farmed some. I used to work at farming, picking cotton. I reckon everybody done pick some cotton. Seth said, I ain't never picked no cotton. I was born up here in the north. My daddy's a free man. I ain't never even seen no cotton. Mr. Loomis done seen some cotton. Ain't you, Harold Loomis? You done picked a bunch of cotton. And he said, how you know so much about me? How much cotton I picked, what I done? He said, I can tell by looking at you. And my daddy taught me how to do that. Say, when you look at a fella, if you taught yourself to look for it, you can see a song written on his, tell you what kind of man he is in the world. Now, I can look at you, Mr. Loomis, and see you a man who done forgot his song. He forgot how to sing it. A fella forget that, and he forget who he is. Forget how he's supposed to mark down life. See, now, I used to travel all up and down this road and that, looking here and there, searching, just like you, Mr. Loomis. I didn't know what I was searching for. The only thing I knew was that something was keeping me dissatisfied. Something wasn't making my heart smooth and easy. Then one day, my daddy gave me a song. Oh, that song had a weight to it that was hard to handle. That song was hard to carry. I fought against it. Didn't want to accept that song. I tried to find my daddy to give him back that song. But I found out it wasn't his song. It was my song. It had come from way deep inside me. I looked long back in memory and gathered up pieces and snatches of things to make that song. I was making it up out of myself. And that song helped me on the road, made it smooth to where my footsteps didn't bite back at me. And all the time, that song getting bigger and bigger, that song growing with each step of the road. It got so I used up all of myself in the making of that song. Then I was a song in search of itself. That song rattling in my throat, and I'm looking for it. You see, Mr. Loomis, when a man forgets his song, he goes off in search of it till he finds out he got it with him all the time. That's why I could tell you one of Joe Turner's niggas, because you forgot how to sing your song.
They tell me Joe Turner's come and gone, oh Lordy.
You just heard August Wilson reading a passage from towards the end of the play, Joe Turner's Come and Gone, and this is New Letters on the Air. Wow. So how much acting have you done?
I never acted. I'm not a performer. I'm a good reader, though. See, there's
you
a difference.
Are. You're
yeah,
a great
I know,
reader.
But you see, in acting, you got to walk and talk. You know, and there's a difference. And I somehow have trouble doing both of them at the same time, you know.
Oh, well, that was fantastic. You know, it's interesting, too, because in some ways, that passage, it rings for all of your plays because your characters are all in search of their song, of their way to express themselves. It's how you see the world. It's like you said a while ago, you know, you're in the grocery store and you can see people in line trying to get themselves out, in
sure,
essence.
Everybody. Well, this goes all the way back to Jesus Christ and Peter and Paul and Judas and all those guys. He used to hang out with him. And, I mean, they're all doing Well, the same thing. They're all searching for their song. They're all trying to find a way to live in the world and give expression to what it means to be alive. And, you know, people find different ways of doing that. The concept of the song in search of itself, he uses all himself up into making the song to where he becomes the song itself. I mean, that's the part in particular that has resonance for me. And then there's another thing that Bynum says earlier when he's talking about binding people up. And he goes, oh, I don't do it lightly. It costs me a piece of myself every time I do. I mean, for instance, I always say when you write the play, you got to leave some blood on the page. You know, if they don't blood on the page, then it's not worth the bother of sitting down and taking the time to write it, you know. And so if it doesn't cost you anything, it's ideally it should cost you something, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one of the things that you are also very good at is weaving history into your plays. And the title of Joe Turner's Come and Gone, that was actually a real song that was out there, right?
It's more than a real song. There was a man named Joe Turney, T-U-R-N-E-Y, who was the brother of Pete Turney, who was the governor of the state of Tennessee. And black folks, you know, the Turney, the way they would say Turney became Turner. But, I mean, this actually happened in that he was, using convict labor and, you know, to work on his plantation and things of the sort. So he would lure Negroes into crap games and arrest them and haul them off and force them to work on his plantation. And he got to be a rich man, made a lot of money off of, you know, free labor, as well as country did, you see.
And to portray African-American culture, I mean, that's been one of your dictates from the get-go, to portray that culture in it all its fullness. Do you feel like you're getting it all out there that you want there?
See, now that's a question you can answer. I can answer that because you as witness to the plays. Am I getting it all out there? You know, then it means I'm doing my job successfully. I think so, yeah. You know, I'm satisfied with the way that the culture is portrayed because ultimately what it says is that it becomes clear that there are no ideas that cannot be contained by black life. This wide philosophical range of ideas and approach to life is uniquely and particularly and the a product of the American experience and an African sensibility that informs our presence here in America. And so it's unlike anything in the world.
I wonder, let's talk a little bit about your life. You grew up in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. Your mother was the defining person in your life because your father sort of wandered out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
At what age were you when he left?
What age was he when I don't
know. What age were you?
I don't know.
Oh, you don't?
No.
So you really don't remember him very much
yes, I
at
don't.
All.
No, why,
oh,
let
you
me
do?
Say, okay. Let me straighten this up for me. I don't know what age I was when he left. He was always a sporadic presence in the household. And I certainly knew him. And as I got older, you know, like 16, 17, I would visit him in his house where he lived at. And he told me a lot of stories and things about his
life.
Did
he live in Pittsburgh?
He lived in Pittsburgh, yes.
Oh, okay.
And when he died in 1965, and he was asking for me, and I went to visit him in the hospital before he died. And, you know, then he died. I went to his funeral and, you know, went out and did all the dutiful things a son should do and mourning him, et cetera. And I wrote a couple poems for him. And then, you know, I go, okay, Pop, it's my turn now. And then I took off to live my life and, you know, haven't too much to look back since.
Do you think there will ever be a place because, you know, your father was this German immigrant? How'd your parents meet?
I have no idea.
You never asked
that
question.
Way before I was born.
Yeah, well,
you know?
Obviously.
I wasn't there. You know?
Anyway, will there ever be a point where you bring a character sort of like your father into the mix?
Oh, yes. That's me. it's okay. Important you understand it. That's me. So my father's all over those pages, you know, because all the characters I made for myself made out of the aspects of my person. I say, well, so who are you? Well, my mother and my father, you know. So he's already there. He's in there. Now, if you're asking whether I'm specifically going to write a character who's a German immigrant, no. I doubt it. I might. I mean, I say no, I might, but that's not what I'm about. None of the characters in any of the plays are modeled after anyone I know.
Sure.
None of the incidents in any of the plays are specific to my life. People go, well, were you Corey? I go, no, that wasn't me, you know. It's my imagination and little aspects. And Bynum says it. I looked long back in memory and gathered up pieces and snatches of things to make up that song. That's what I do. I look long back in memory. I take a little piece here, a little snatch of this, and a little thing here, and put them all together. But there's no way that my father could not be in those plays.
Mm-hmm. None of them are you, and all of them are you.
Yeah, exactly, yes.
Yeah.
And that's who I am. Yeah.
Do you still write poetry?
Yes, I do.
Do you do it regularly?
I do it whenever the occasion for a poem strikes me, which means if I do not want to write poetry, I have to stay away from my wife because she is occasional poetry. Her presence is an occasional poetry. And so,
well, there's such poetry in your plays. Was that a hard transition to make? Because in the beginning, didn't you start with poetry?
Oh, yeah, I started with poetry. You know, it's all words on a paper.
What was the impetus to go to your first play? What spurred that?
My friend Claude Purdy, you know, he came to a poetry reading that I did in Pittsburgh, and I had a character named Black Bart. Bart was a magician. I had a whole series. Bart was, anyway, he said, man, you just make a play out of them. I mean, you can't make no play out of no poem, you know. Anyway, he kept after me, and, you know, to get him off my back, from one Sunday to the next, I sat down and I wrote this 137-page musical satire of American society called Black Bart and the Sacred Heels. And anyway, then I got a call from Claude. I said, man, why don't you come out here and rewrite this play, you know? And he sent me a ticket, and no one had ever sent me a ticket to go anywhere. And I didn't have anything to lose, so to speak, so I got on a plane and went to St. Paul. You know,
and that's a huge theater town.
It was. And it was like cool, and I rewrote the play and I went back home. And then he called me again, said he had a theater in California and wanted to do a stage reading of the play. So he says, you know, come out, let's go out to California, stop in St. Paul and pick me up. But it was Claude who got me writing plays, and he was just so encouraged. Oh, Will, you bad, man. You got. So he had that belief in me that it, you know, encouraged me to have it in myself. Yeah, so that's more or less how I got to writing plays. You know?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Well, that's pretty neat. Well, do you have any of your poems committed to memory could recite for us?
There's one called, I don't know if it's Lust or Desire, but at 17, I entered the fray, throwing dazzling combinations only to be floored by the right cross of a woman's smile. I rise with unrepentant glee, stagger to my corner to wait to start a round two. I like the unrepentant glee, you know. Anyway, that's the last poem I remember writing.
Unrepented glee. That would be a good description of what I sense from you when it comes to you and writing, actually. I mean, the pure joy it sounds like that you get out of sharing this and just putting it out there in the world.
Well, see, I think you hit the nail on the head. It certainly is a joyful process. And I as often said and had characters say, and then someone here titled the book, I'm sorry for nothing I've done. So that's the unrepentant part in the glee. As I found out as I get older, it's also very, very brief, you know, a little flash and we're gone. And there's just, so why not enjoy it? Why are you here? You know, why not find something, some, you know, measure? Because, you know, life is just, it's not all one thing. It's this combination of joy and pain and loss and gain and all the things all rolled up into one massive ball of energy or whatever. And it's like, hey, man, I'm part of this thing.
August Wilson, in 2002, while at the Missouri Repertory Theater, now the Kansas City Rep, to see their production of Joe Turner's Come and Gone. We plan to talk again after he completed his cycle of plays about African-American life in each decade of the 20th century, but he died in October 2005 at the age of 60, having just finished his 10th play, Radio Golf. His work continues to live on stage, and in 2017, his screenplay for Fences is an Academy Award finalist. A production of New Letters Magazine at UMKC, our website is newletters.org. Follow us on Facebook, Tumblr, and Twitter at New Letters Radio. Today's show was originally produced with Leslie Koffler and Dennis Conroe. Thanks also to Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.